Oh, I love the lighting. Oh, my God. My name's Mike Lee, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And talk about an honor. I want to thank Scott and Marianne, the committee, for letting me do this. And for the basket, I understand Otto got a car. I'm not quite sure why he got a car in his basket, and I got nuts, but I was grateful for my basket, too. Did you get a car, Otto? Okay. I got so much going on inside of me right now, I told Mary to give me the sign, you know, if I start to ramble, but I want to welcome the newcomers, and I want to thank the old-timers. And I am beyond excited about being part of this roundup at this level. My first roundup was 1983 at Spring Roundup, and Harriet and Stu, I had gotten sober June 30th, 1982's my home group. What is this, sis? What is it? Sunday Morning Yellow Cab is my home group. June 30th, 1982 is my... I told you I was nervous. June 30th, 82 is my sobriety date. And my home group said he boarded a yellow cab. My sponsors here, my sponsor-in-law, my sponsees and my grand sponsees. And I'm like going 180 miles an hour. I've never been so nervous to talk. And it was because of this roundup. And Harriet and Stu were part of starting this roundup. And I was the newcomer, and they said I got to come to the spring roundup, which I had no idea what it was. I'm an AA virgin, and that means I just came here once. And I didn't know anything about roundups and all that sort of stuff, and I gotten to be the usher girl and the ticket girl and the literature girl and the cup girl and the hostess girl and the trash girl. And then I got to serve on the committee for a number of years and to be asked to be of service at any level at this roundup's an honor and a privilege. So that's kind of what I wanted to start with. Jesus, I'm tired already. I mean it. And it start. This is okay, what else I was thinking. When I was young here, I used to make sure I had pretty panties in my purse just in case I met him. And today, and my friend Dave from Laguna will relate, I ran back for my nitro, you know. So I want to give the newcomers hope that if you do not drink here and you are in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous the whole run, you will get sober and old. And if you remember any kind of underwear, you're good, but don't. Don't forget the nitro. So I really have grown here. My Al-Anon sponsor's here, and I want to say how much that means to me, too. Everything. I started crying this morning because, you know, I never knew to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I never knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I was broke. And I knew that probably at the age of 5. And I don't talk a lot about my childhood because it doesn't appear relevant. I could have been raised by Jesus, Mary, and Joseph or the Charles Manson family. You know, it's me. Always was, always will be. And I grew up in Catholic school, and I was going to be a nun, and that's what everybody was going to be that was weird in those days. And you were going to dress up in nun outfits, and at the talent show, I was the singing nun. And, you know, I mean, that was just what I grew up around, and I had good intentions. And like Gary said today at one of the meetings we went to, you know, I'm not a recovering Catholic. I loved that. I love statues and candles and stuff. I love it. And I'd not sinned yet. I kept making up confession because I like confession. And I couldn't get a sin going yet, but you had to go every week to confession, so I just make up stuff because I hadn't done anything yet. And I went to my first dance where there were no nuns present and had my first drink. And the order of that, I was going into a mother house. And if you're going to be a nun, you go into a mother house, which keeps you a virgin until you can be a nun, basically. And I went to a party and I had my first drink, and the next day I couldn't be a nun anymore. And certainly not in that order, you know. And I was very mature for my age of 14. And I'm brilliant. I might as well just say it now. And I always have a backup plan. I realized if you couldn't be a nun, you had to have a backup plan. My backup plan was to be a go-go dancer. And so I was a go-go dancer next. And danced at a place in Phoenix called the Pirate's Den. Very fancy place. And minimum wage there was 65 cents an hour, and you made $4 an hour cash. And I had a secret goal, and the secret goal was to be like Donna Reed. And she was kind of a mother knows best type, for those of you that don't know who she is, but she's like perfect. She wore pearls, and she did everything wonderfully. And I saved up all my go-go money, and I came to California, and I found a sailor, and I got married, and I was almost 15. And very mature for my age, so. And the way I started growing up was I watched Mother Knows Best, Father Knows Best, Donna Reed show, and all those shows to show me what came next, because I really had no idea what I was doing, but being a kid was totally stressful to me. And, you know, what the next 20 years plus was like for me was pretending to be a legitimate person. I've never been to high school because it looked stressful to me, and I try to avoid that stuff. But I went to college, and then I just lie. Whatever I wanted to do, I just say whatever I needed to say to do whatever I needed to do. And I got a stethoscope and a uniform, and I worked in an emergency room, and I had about 57 kids. And I was a Girl Scout leader, and I was just pretending to do everything I saw them do on TV. And I liked it. I liked it. I was always afraid they were going to find out, but I liked it. And the only kind of guys I liked were good-looking alcoholics with potential. Seems to be my MO, huh, Shirley? And I thought I was so bad about that. And basically, the majority of my beginning story was martyred Al-Anon. I like suffering. I just overshot the mark. And basically what happened is I tried to do everything right, and it was very hard. I don't know if you've ever tried to be legitimate when you're not a legitimate person, but about wear you out. And what happened to me was I found alcohol. And I don't know if you've ever drank much, but it will relax you. And I liked it. I liked being relaxed. And it actually kind of started here at Town & Country. It was kind of funny. I'd never been in bars since I was a kid dancing in one. I knew nice mothers didn't go to bars. And I had had to make my alcoholic leave because he was breaking up my happily ever after stuff. And a bunch of people that I knew from work went to the Stardust Country Club here at Town & Country. And they danced, and they had fun, and they had dinner, and I hadn't done, like, grown-up stuff. Everything I did was around the kids. And I didn't know if I should go to a bar. And then I came here, and I went to the Stardust Country Club, and there was lights, and it was fancy, and somebody loaned me a fancy dress because I only had uniforms and house clothes, you know. And I fell in love with the... Well, I wasn't going to say it was a drummer in case he's still here, but it was a deep, meaningful relationship, as I remember. I think in the music storage room or something like that, but it was an important relationship for me. And it was like Cinderella. It was when alcohol made me all better. It had never done that before. It had done stuff, and I drank once in a while at the ER Christmas party and stuff like that, but it had never, I'd never been so broke, so it never worked so well. And I thought, I'm going to do this once a month. I'm going to come to with these people, and I'm going to come and be a grown-up, and I'm not going to be a mom, and not going to work, and I'm just going to do this once a month. And I have the progressive disease of alcoholism, and what that means is it's going to take you where it's going to take you without your permission. Your full participation, but not with your permission, because I would have never went where I went. I drove the golf cart here. I got 86 out of here because I drove a golf cart into the swimming pool for fun. And I hated making amends for that one here because I really thought it was pretty funny. And apparently it's expensive to dry those things out or something. So one of my checks came here. One of my checks came to across the street for stealing salt and pepper shakers. My sponsor was a stickler for amends, you know. But I went from I was going to go once a month to I was going to go once or twice a month because I was getting to relax for the first time. Just relax. That's all I was going for. Just relax. And then it was like you realize like once a week would make more sense and be better. And, you know, because you work all week, and the kids and scouts and soccer and Little League and dance, and it was just a lot. I had a lot of kids that did a lot of things. And once a week does make sense if you think about it. And then I thought, hump day, everybody from the ER went to happy hour on hump day. And I don't know why they call this happy hour. I never did an hour. I did happy evening, and I did happy night, but I overshot the hour thing, you know. It was like, but when you start getting more and more relaxed, I mean, why would you not want to do that? That was kind of, I mean, I wasn't thinking that pretty soon I'd be 86 from places like this and I'd have to move into La Mesa and then I'd have to move into Lakeside. And Lakeside, if you've ever drank in Lakeside, I hope you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because it is bad. You know, but I liked it. I kind of felt like Girl Scout leader gone wild, you know. It was just like, yeah. And I was sick of crafts, you know, and I taught primary of the Mormon Church, and I was smoking and drinking a glass of wine because the kids were getting on my last nerve, and I knew that that wasn't part of the thing, but I was a stressed-out primary teacher, you know, and it was just, I was just going to take a break. And I have the progressive disease of alcoholism. And pretty soon, those kids could figure out, I thought, I'm sick of carpooling. I don't know if you've ever been a carpool mom, but they'll take advantage of you. And you learn in Al-Anon set boundaries. So I was setting them. I was setting them on dinner, homework, and meals. Anything that involved any effort on my part was now my new boundary. They need to be more self-sufficient. They're sucking the life out of me, really. And they don't appreciate you. And if you have the progressive disease of alcoholism, you better get an attitude because it's going to get ugly. And you're going to turn on everybody you really like and everybody that you really love. You'll hurt twice as bad. And that's what I did, and that's what this disease does. It destroys families. It destroyed mine. And more than once. And God felt sorry for me. This is what I know to be the truth for me, because if you don't know what to do, God will do for you what you don't know what to do for yourself. If you know, you're going to have to pray for willingness and do some hump work. But if you don't know, God will feel sorry for you if he knows. I just know this. That's what happened to me. June 30th, 1982, I came out of a blackout. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where the kids were. That had never happened. And I did the Dear God prayer, but I did the Dear God, if you're really there prayer. And what happened was he had me call AA Central, which I would have not known to do that. And then he had a lady named Flo come 12-step me, and I didn't know what that meant. And then I just vomited the truth. I told her more information than I know that she wanted to know. I now know that. I did. I thought she wanted to know. I think she asked me something, and then I talked for a half an hour. But I had never told anybody the truth about anything because I knew that if you knew. I mean, the only reason I had an in was because of where I worked and who I knew and the kids I had and the committees I served on. But I told her about the other stuff. And she says, I'm going to take you to be an AA and it's going to be okay. And I said, okay, I'll be an AA. There was some relief just knowing I was going to be an AA and I had no idea what it was. None. I didn't even know anything. And she says, but I want you to call me before you drink today. And I thought, oh, no, I don't want to drink. I want to be an AA. I'm going to be an AA now. I'm going to join AA. I will be an AA. I'm there. I'm never going to drink. Which you know last 2 hours. You know, I didn't know that. Because if you're going to join AA, you will get thirstier than the day before you were going to join an AA. Because you have a sense it's over. And I'm like starting to panic. And I thought, well, you can drink here. They just want you to check in first. So I called her, you know, and I said, you know, I'm going to drink and be an AA. I don't think I'll make it till tonight. And I'm very nervous this morning. I don't know why I'm so nervous. You know, I'm just, well, because I didn't know how to go 2 hours without a drink. I drank at work. I drank all the time. And I didn't, 2 hours is long. And she went, wah, 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 wah. And I went, no, I don't want to drink. I want to be an AA. I'm going to be an AA. Drinking is bad. AA is good. I'm there. I got it. 2 hours later, I'm going to need to drink to be an AA. Back on the phone, you know? No, drinking is bad. I'm going to be an AA. Blah, 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 blah. And every time, you know, so I'm warning the newcomers, if you call before you drink, you will end up being sober almost 27 years because they trick you. You're not checking in. You're giving them an opportunity to let God work through them, and it's like it'll throw off your whole plan, you know. And finally at 5, I realized that with these people, you got to put your foot down. You know, because they get pushy after a few hours, you know, And I'm calling her, and I'm telling her this time I am drinking some wine and being an AA. And, I mean, I'm realized I'm going to have to be real clear because I've tried it several times that day, and she's not getting it, you know. And I keep being sober, and it's stressing me out. Now I've gone as long as I can go. And what I said was, if you don't hurry and get here, I mean, hurry. I won't be able to be an AA. And it's like, never give them your address, you know. It's like she's waiting for that call. I think she just knew. But in she comes, you know. And she babysat me so I could go to my first meeting, which was Thursday night, Channel Road, Lakeside, June 30th, 1982. And relapse is not mandatory. It's an option, but it is not mandatory. Because I got there, and some guy said his name was Joe, and he'd been sober, you know, 30 days, and everybody clapped, and I thought, oh, man, you got to say your name. You're an alcoholic, and, you know, and I'm, like, sweating. They call it detoxing. I just called it nerves, you know, and I was just like, and I said, I'm Michaeline. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober 11 hours. Well, they loved it. They totally went nuts. I had no idea that they're, like, totally into hours at this meeting, you know, and they're like, yeah, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know. So now I perk up, you know, I'm like. So I said, and I was awake, because I thought, I want credit for the whole 11 hours. It's not like I was sleeping and sober. I've been awake and sober 11 hours, and I wasn't trying to be funny. I thought, I don't know how they count your time around here, but I wanted credit for the whole 11 hours, because it's very, very long. You know, and I'm just exhausted by 11 hours. And I'm like, nobody had been proud of me in a very long time. And you guys were so proud of me. Clap, clap, clap. Rah, rah, rah. Phone number after phone number after. And then invited me to go to Bob's Big Boy right after the meeting. And I'm like, I didn't get it, but I was staying. I thought, I'm staying. And then they're going to drop you off. And I was like, and now what am I going to do overnight? Now it's a freak show again, you know. And they're going, call anytime. Call anytime before you drink. Well, I didn't call that night because I did not want to look as pathetic as I actually was. And somebody had said, you know, here, some are sicker than others. And I looked around, I thought, no kidding. I mean, how sad. I mean, it's, look around. I'm from La Mesa, you know, I'm like, but it was a long night. And then the next morning, I was willing to make the call. And then, and that's what it started like for me. It was, they didn't have disorders then. They had detoxing. Whatever was you were going through, you're detoxing. I'm very nervous while you're detoxing. Eat some sugar and have some vitamin B stuff. I said, well, I don't really eat much sugar. And they said, no, you've been drinking 5 pounds a week. Eat a candy bar. Trust me. You know, I'm like, okay. They didn't want to nurture your inner child. They encouraged you to find an inner adult, which was the one that appeared to be missing, you know. And I was like, okay. So I didn't get sober around these warm, nurturing sort of people. They were mean to me. And thank God, because if I would have asked you to baby me and you would have, I would have been drinking still till the day I died. I need somebody to get my attention. And the people at the bar, my best friends were now Brute Bill and Toothless Annie, and they were very nurturing. I loved them. They would buy me drinks, and I would be sad, and they would buy me more drinks, so I would get hysterical, and then I'd get more drinks than I'd ever had, and then I'd go home and be fine. Here, it didn't fly. And what I realized after a couple weeks of sobriety was that I was gonna, you know, I was kind of getting worse. I was sitting in a very big job at a very big hospital that I really wasn't qualified to do. If they would have ever checked my background and my pretend credentials, and I was looking at this thing at 2 weeks sober, I thought, I don't really get this job. I don't really know how I got this job. I don't know how I've been in the field for 13 years. Certainly don't know how I've been promoted, but I have to leave now. And I went in and I told the director, I said, I have to leave. I'm in AA. I'm an alcoholic. I'm in AA now. She went, really? Oh, yeah, I'm bad. I was drinking here. And I said, I have to go to a meeting, and I'm like freaking out, you know. And she's like, go ahead, take the rest of the day, take tomorrow, you know. I said, oh, no, I have to quit. I don't think I'm going to be able to work and be sober. It's like too much. I'm not really qualified for this job. And I have to hurry because I, you know, if 2 more weeks I get to be in charge of the trash at the meeting, and you know, I have a lot of stuff going on now, and I'll just not be able to work anymore. And I left, and I went home, and I sat in my mental patient rocking chair, and which just goes really fast, and you go nowhere, waiting to be an AA, you know, and waiting for the next meeting. And the kids keep walking by me, and they're scaring me. They're scaring me because there's so many of them, and they want things. And I'm now in AA, you know, and I'm just not going to be able to do a lot except be in AA. And they're like, can you take us to here? I don't think I can drive right now. I just can't drive. Not drunk, I'm good. Sober, not doing too well. I mean, sober's stressful. You know, I say this, they still do H&I at detox, and I go in there and they're like relaxed. I don't know if you've ever seen them on the mats, but they don't look stressed. The H&I panel looks stressed. You know, we're stressed. They're fine, and we're trying to get them to come be like us, you know, so you really have to be very careful, you know, but I couldn't function. I could not think. I could not do this. And I had not opened the mailbox in 2 months. And they had put a thing on my door that said, please come get your mail at the post office because you won't come get it at your mailbox, which is the most insane thing I've ever heard. So if I wanted the mail, I would have gone 8 feet to the mailbox. So now I don't want the mail, and I'm going to drive across town to the post office and pick up a bunch of mail that I don't want. Well, some of the things in the mail I should have looked at. You know, one included the house, one included the car, one included stuff. And by the time I got my 90-day token, it was all gone, and the kids had to go to Coronado and stay at their dad's. And I was sitting there with all I had left was my mental patient rocking chair, and they were now going to auction that off. And they auctioned off her things. And somebody, her name was Pat W., and she had a camping trailer that she'd just bought. And what I thought I heard her say was, "I have a mobile home you can stay in." And I said, you know, like, well, you know, I don't really want to go in a mobile home. And she said, "You have no other options." And there were only a couple recovery homes in, and they were full. And so I said, okay, I'll live in a mobile home. And it was a 14-foot camping trailer with red shag carpeting, and somebody had brought me a bicycle because the Volvo was gone. And I mean, look at me. Do I look like a bicyclist? You know, it's just like, I'm not a camper. I mean, I'm just not really. I am a recovering princess in my own mind, and I am now living in a 14-foot camping trailer with red shag carpeting, which is not one of my colors, and riding a Boyschwood paper bike. And it's like, and my sponsor's bringing me a roll of dimes to ride my bicycle to Taco Leo's to call her every night. And I'm doing it. And I'm telling her my sad, 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 sad story every single day. She's got to hear it. And one night she encouraged me to skip a meeting. You know, I was only going to 8 a day. And she just like, you know, "Why don't you stay home tonight?" I didn't know she wanted a break. And she just was, because I was like a freak show every 5 minutes. I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. I've got too much record. The kids have been, when the kids come home, and he's a bad dude. You know, and she's like, "Stay home. I'm going to give you a list of things I want you to do tonight at home." And I said, "Okay." And she says, "It's going to be very good for you. Went to the noon meeting. This will be good for you." And she gave me a list of stuff to do. I got it done by 5:30. I made it to the 6 o'clock meeting. And I said, "Oh, my God, I got them all done." You know, how she didn't drink is, you know, the interesting story, you know, because I'm a little needy here. And that really was what I was like. You know, what I was like always seems to match everybody else's what I was like. You know, if I talk about what I was like, not what I did. But what I'm like drunk is one thing. What I'm like sober is 10 times worse. You know, it's like, I always think it's like being naked. You know, I'm looking around, y'all looking pretty good to me. If everybody was sitting around naked, it would not be pretty. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but it ain't pretty. And that's what sober felt like to me. I thought you could see everything, and I was so embarrassed. And then you take off all your clothes, too, and I think, well, they're not all that either. And everybody was sharing all this stuff, and so I learned to get honest here by going, "Me too. Me too." I wouldn't start first, but if you said it out loud, anything about who you were and how you'd felt and what you had done, then I could go, "Me too." And that's what I did. And I asked her one night, I was really having it come apart, and I was trying to get a boyfriend. I was riding my bicycle. I had a selling plasma because I'd run out of money, and had a fishing cap with a lure. And I'm looking good. I mean, I don't know what to tell you, but I could not get a date. Go figure. Yeah, I got like 90 days now, and I got a bicycle, nice bicycle, good fishing cap with the lure on it, and because I lost my visors in storage, you know, plasma bandage, free soda pop as soon as I sell that. And I'm trying to get a date, and I ride my bicycle to Taco Leo's at 10 o'clock at night. I call my sponsor, and I'm going, "I need a boyfriend." So bad. To be an AA with me, you know. And she says, "Ask God to hold you tonight." Yeah, exactly. I'm like, yeah. Anybody that's getting laid regularly will tell you to have God hold you tonight. You know, I thought, I mean, I picked up on that one really fast, you know. She's in a bed. She's got a television. I didn't, you know. I know what she's doing. But if you can't get a boyfriend and you're going to have a nervous breakdown sober, you will ask God to hold you. And you ask him to let you feel it, and then God will let you feel it, and then you'll know. And by the next morning, I wasn't sure if I really felt it or if I just imagined I felt it, but it was kind of like, well, what if I did feel it? Well, I'm going to do it again tonight. And after a few nights of that, I knew something I'd never known before, and what came to me was to take these steps. The same thing came to me this morning that came to me then, and that was make sure my relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for me and countless others. And they weren't talking about a guy. So I made sure my relationship with him was right. And I started writing hopeless, desperate, pathetic, childlike God letters every single day. 2 and 3 a day. Dear God, I hope you're really there. If you're not there, don't tell me. You know? Dear God, I love AA. I'm so grateful you brought me here. I can't believe I'm sober. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Dear God, I hate this place. I don't know if I'm going to make it. I don't even know. Why would that ugly lady get a boyfriend and I don't? Dear. Heartfelt prayers, you know, but it was all true. And I've always done the same thing. I've always told God before I told you. Always. And God's given me the courage to then go on and say it out loud. And I'm not doing it any different today. And pretty soon the kids are coming home and I think I'm going to have that down, and pretty soon I've got a place to live, and pretty soon I'm getting a job back in healthcare, and you know, pretty soon Carl from the club says I got a surprise for you. I said, what is it? He said, I brought you a car. Kids are coming home, you're going to need your car. I said, I went out there and I was so excited, and you know, I knew it'd be shiny and probably be a Volvo. It might be an older one, but he knew I had had one. And it was a red Pinto. And I said, no, thank you. And I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I didn't want to appear, but I thought, I am not driving a red Pinto. I had red shag carpeting my first year of sobriety, and if you think I'm driving a red Pinto the second year, you're wrong. And I called my sponsor. I said, you will not believe this. I said, Carl brought me a free car. And she says, oh, my God, another gift from God. And I went, yeah, an ugly wrapping paper. It's a Pinto. Red. She goes, I do not believe you. You are the most ungrateful person I've ever sponsored. And God keeps giving you gifts and you think everything's just so below you. And I heard her. And she says, you call Carl and you tell him you're so sorry. You can't help it. You're going to keep taking these steps and you will get better, and to please bring back the car. And I want to say I wanted to. But she was pissed, and I did it, you know, basically, is what happened. And next thing I know, I'm driving a red Ford Pinto. Humbled was an understatement. With door dents and things. And it was funny, because as I started taking the steps, the car got prettier. It was amazing. Pretty soon, it looked like, almost like a red Jag. I love my car. I'm out there shining my car, you know? I'm giving newcomers rides. I could do it. I have never lost sight of my priorities here, not because I'm all that, because I pray so much. God knows that I'm the kind of alcoholic that is willing to die drunk. There's an alcoholic woman inside of me that isn't any different than she was almost 27 years ago, and she's okay dying drunk. She's okay hurting the people she loves, and she will take an easier, softer way. And I've had a fit spiritual condition since the very first day of my journey with you guys, and that is because I'll pick up the phone first. That's how you get a fit spiritual condition. I thought it was going to be a lot more complex, but it wasn't that hard. I've been painstaking about these steps, and I'll tell you, they have been a pain. Oh, my God. Making amends to kids, making amends to employers. The things that I had to do to clean up the wreckage were unbelievable, but one of my biggest amends had to do with my dad. My mom had died when I was young and left me her kids, too. And my dad had just kind of, we weren't gelling. And he was gone a lot. And it took me 5 years of inventory to get to my part. And the day I got to my part, I realized I'd always wanted him to be a good dad. I had never been a great daughter. I wanted him to remember my birthday. I wasn't even sure what month his was in. Everything had always been perceived differently. And I flew back to Texas, and which is where I was born, and I made arrangements. I said, can I have a cup of coffee with you? I'm going to be in town. He said, yeah. He said, maybe we can get in a game of cribbage. I said, sounds good. And I knew that I had a new father, and he was taking good care of me, and I had all of you. And I'd taken these steps, and the things were starting to turn around, and they were different, and I was different. And I just wanted to go be a good daughter, and I wanted to tell him I was so sorry for all of the damage I'd created. I'd always pushed him beyond a comfort zone. It wasn't who he was, and I was overly needing what only God could fill up. And that's an awful lot of pressure to put on a person. And about an hour before I went to meet with him and make these amends, my aunt, I don't know if you've ever been to Texas, but they're just not that sharp sometimes. They'll do weird things, you know. Sorry, Nancy, but I'm telling you. They just say things. And my aunt, I was telling her about these amends I was going to make, and she says, oh, honey, that's not even your real daddy. And I said, you mean I'm not German? Now, that was my first response. I thought I looked like a Jew from the Bronx. Everybody thinks I'm a Jew from the Bronx. I thought I was German. I don't look like the other German people in my family, little noses and blonde hair, but I really thought it was my dad. And she goes, oh, I'm sorry, honey. I thought you knew. Well, anyway. And I raced to the Legacy Club there outside of Houston, and I ran into this old-timer named Lois, and I told Lois my psychodrama, and I went racing in like Kramer, and she just looked at me like I was totally insane, and I came here, and my dad, and I'm a German, I'm a Greek or a Jew, and it's like my mother was a restaurant guy, and I just, and she's just looking at me, and she goes, honey, a daddy's a daddy. Just go clean that up. That's what you came to Texas for, right? Well, yeah. She goes, well, don't make no, never mind. And then she just looked around at the group and she said, let's just have a meeting on acceptance. And it changed me. It didn't make no, never mind. By the end of the meeting, I thought, whatever. Out here, they'll put you on Oprah with that story. In Texas, they say, get a grip. A daddy's a daddy. Go clean up your stuff. The end. They don't want you to write about it. They don't think you need psychotherapy. They just get a grip. And I got a grip. And we got to be close, beyond close, before he died. He became an incredible father, and I became an incredible daughter. I mean, it was amazing we got that chance. And painstaking for me was really doing that thing until I was no longer a victim. I mean, no more. I either caused it, I set it up, I created it, I encouraged it, I embellished it, whatever. But I thought these steps just kept changing me to where pretty soon it was smoothing out. And what I know, how am I doing on time? Somebody tell me, because... Okay. One of the things I knew was that I'd need help raising those kids, I'd need help making those amends, I'd need help doing a lot of different things here that I thought I wasn't going to have that much difficulty. When they said some were sicker than others, they were talking about me. The ones for me that I've worked with that are sicker than others are the ones that don't think they're sicker than others. The ones that have thought that I'm just as sick as the others, we seem to recover as if our life depends on it. I'm doing the same things that I was doing almost 27 years ago. I go to a lot of meetings. I have service commitments. I do make some sort of a commitment at every meeting I go to. I answer the phone. I make the calls. You know, I've had two heart attacks here. I've had open heart surgery. I was with the man of my dreams. He dropped dead. You got me through that. A month ago, Prince Charming number 87 went out the door, relapsed, and it's been a rough month. And there, half the women I sponsor, my sponsor flew in. It was like, it wasn't like I was going to drink. I like being stable. I didn't miss any of my commitments this month. I didn't not answer the phone. I did not show up for my service commitments. I didn't skip a prayer or reading one. I've had about 18 minutes collectively of self-pity. Probably about a good hour and a half of just pissed off. Probably about 3.5 hours of complete overwhelm. And what I realized this morning and yesterday morning and the day before that is God's world's in perfect order. God's world's always been in perfect order. My world has not always been in perfect order. My world, I can create chaos. If not all invited in every few years, what the hell? But I know that God never has to worry about me because we stay close. And because we stay close, I let you close. The women I sponsor, I share with them what I was like, what happened, what I'm really like. The only time I almost drank was at 6.5 years sober when I started trying to share what I wished I was like or what I should be like or what, for Christ's sake, I want you to think I'm like. But today I share what I was like, what happened, what I'm really like now. I got spiritual moxie because of you. I'm no lightweight anymore. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not moving out of the center. And I'm going to need your help to keep going on the journey. So thanks for letting me share.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.